You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, George Lakey, nonviolent movement strategist, organizer, teacher, and author, joins us to speak about his new book, Viking Economics, and about how Sweden, Norway, Denmark, and Iceland use nonviolent action to gain long-lasting economic justice, and how we, here in the U.S., can follow in their footsteps.
Both Sweden and Norway, the struggle came to a heading, and both the economic elites of Sweden and Norway found that they could no longer rule, that their countries had become ungovernable, that people simply wouldn't do what they were told to do. They were just non-cooperating to such a high degree. And general strikes would completely disrupt the economy. And as a result, it was possible in those two countries to create, you might say, to open the space to be inventive and create a new economy.
Stood before you with her hands on her hips. She said, I'll accept love and loving words from your lips. She said, everything changes with conviction like this. I need you to be good right now. I need you to be good, good, and how. I need you to be love right now. I need you to be
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Aguano, Golazikuoba, Wulikaskit. Welcome and greetings to you in my native language. It's a beautiful day here. I'm coming to you from my home in the Dawnland in Bunawabskeg territory in and along the shores of the mighty and beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine. And as always, I'm joined by my magnificent co-host, Miss Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Hello, Sherry. It's an interesting day out here in New Mexico. We recently had the first pretty big forest fire of the year, and it filled the dawn with smoke, an eerie pink tinge smoke. And if you've ever been out in the Southwest during a forest fire, it's a very strange experience because it's aromatic. It smells amazing because of the pinyon, but it's also this reminder that climate change is real, it's happening, and one way our Southwest forests are going away is through these forest fires. It brings to your doorstep in the morning this kind of like reminder that our work matters, our lives matter, our choice matter, and that what we choose to focus on and work on in our lives is critical this time around for all of us. Now, this is very pertinent to today's show because we're going to interview a man who has committed his life to working on peace and justice, and not just in half-hearted ways, but in full body and soul, heart and spirit, mind ways. Our guest today is George Lakey, and for those who don't know his amazing track record, he is a giant in the field of nonviolence. He has given so much to the movements. He has been on the front lines of almost every major struggle you've heard of, and many that you might not have on your radar yet. Some of the most remarkable work in the field of nonviolent justice making in our world has involved George Lakey as a part of it. Now, he's coming on the show today to talk about his ninth book, Viking Economics, and all of his writing is in the nature of doing homework for the movements to support activism and a better world for all of us. He's been arrested in the pursuit of peace and justice more times than I'm sure the U.S. government would like to count, and he's also, among many other amazing things that he's initiated in this world, he's the co-founder of Earthquaker Action Team, which our listeners will remember from our discussion with Eileen Flanagan earlier on this year. Welcome to the show, George, and thank you for honoring us and the listeners with sharing your thoughts, perspective, and wisdom today.
Thanks for inviting me back, Rivera. I really appreciate it.
Well, George, I'm happy to get to know you now. I know that you were a guest on Occupy Radio, and having you now as a guest on Love and Revolution Radio is a great treat for me. I've heard many stories of you over the years and have been excited to have this conversation with you. I think it's going to be wonderful, not only for Rivera and I, but for our listeners as well. Now, let's go to your new book, Viking Economics. It's an intriguing title, and maybe not what people would imagine when they consider what it might be about. So this is about looking at the economies of Norway and Sweden. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to understand these systems, what drew you to them, and what you find intriguing about them, kind of just to start us off in a nutshell?
My first encounter with Norway was marrying into the country, because I married a Norwegian woman who I had met in the U.S. She was an exchange student here, and for various reasons, I needed to go to Norway and marry her, and I really wanted to get to know her language and her culture and, most of all, her family. And so that was my introduction as a young adult. And I was bowled over, frankly, by how different it was in many ways from the U.S. And I thought, well, this is just cultural differences. This is first time out of the country, George, so get used to it. And it actually took a long time for me returning again and again, visiting with family and doing work in Norway and also in Sweden and in Denmark. It took a while before I realized, just back and forth comparing systems and getting to know other countries, living in the United Kingdom for a while, and realizing that they did have a very distinctive economic model over there that came through very strongly for the value of individual freedom. So I found, for example, that they had more individual freedom than we do in the U.S. That astonished me, because there's such a lot of self-praise here for how much individual freedom we have. And then the remarkable degree of equality that they have. And I found that those two values, it's easy to have those values. We have them, those values, a lot of us do in this country too, but that those were rooted in, and not so much rooted in actually as underlined and raised up by their economic system. And I thought this would be good for people to know. So every once in a while I would refer to it when I was doing a workshop or presentation, and people were not very interested, because after all, the U.S. is the best in the world in every respect, right? And then 2008 happened, and because of that crash and the Great Recession that followed it, I found Americans opening their minds and saying, well, maybe this isn't the best of all possible worlds. Maybe there's another way of handling an economy that doesn't put so much suffering on people. And that's when I realized I should get systematic. I should go back again and again, interview economists, political scientists, interview people in the street, interview my relatives, interview immigrants, interview all kinds of people that I can run into in Norway, Sweden, Denmark. And then I also included Iceland, because I realized that one of the things all four of those countries have in common is the ancient Viking heritage. But also all four of them share this modern economic model. And that's why I wrote the book. It took years of research and writing, but it was really worth it, because I came into a kind of clarity about this being a definable model that could be borrowed from anytime we chose. And wouldn't it be great for my people, the American people, to know about this?
George, when I think about Vikings, I think about the ships with the sails and the oars and the, you know, the like classic stereotypical Viking helmet and their reputation as being fierce warriors. But one of the things that I have heard a rumor that your book actually addresses is the use of nonviolent action, specifically around the 1930s onward. A little bit of a varying date, depending on which country we're looking at, but the use of coordinated nonviolent action to change the economic system and the political systems that really enabled a huge 1% or a very small and wealthy 1%, I would say, to manipulate the entire populaces. Can you tell us a little bit about this historic arc and the use of nonviolent struggle in that context?
Sure, happy to, because it is a surprise. After all, the Vikings were very, you know, were famous for their bloody violence and stealing from other peoples and so on. They probably weren't any worse than anybody else in those days, but still, 1,000 years ago, you didn't want to run into a Viking. And so it was a big departure from that bloody tradition when they decided to take on their economic elite. And very strong social movements grew up, mostly around working class people wanting to stop being oppressed and impoverished, and small farmers who were also put very much in jeopardy by the capitalist system. And so the farmers and the workers got together, which has not always happened, of course, but it was a very, very smart thing for them to do, put those two groups together in a coalition. And then they chose nonviolence. And that was so interesting because the workers' movement, the Labour Party in Norway and the different parties were named different things in the different countries, were very influenced by the communist movement right next door in the Soviet Union. And in fact, the Norwegian Labour Party became an official Communist Party with representation in the Comintern, and their leadership would go to Moscow and participate in meetings with Lenin and so on. So the atmosphere that they breathed was very pro-armed struggle. But then on the train on the way home, they would talk about it and they would say, does armed struggle really make sense in Norway? Can't we think of something better? And they did think of something better. So that itself was highly innovative. And I think a real signal or a kind of symbol of what they would do in the future, innovated in economics. Well, first of all, they innovated in the very means of change that they chose. And so in addition to the strike, which you'd expect workers to do, they did a lot of occupations, a lot of demonstrations, basically street heat, as we might call it these days. And when farmers would get foreclosed on by banks, the neighbors from all over the place would gather in a mass of people and refuse to allow the auctions to take place, that kind of thing. And in both Sweden and Norway especially, the struggle roughly at the same time came to a heading in the 30s. And both the economic elites of Sweden and Norway found that they could no longer rule, that their countries had become ungovernable, that people simply wouldn't do what they were told to do. They were just non-cooperating to such a high degree. Even though troops were pulled out, even though people were killed for demonstrating, and general strikes would completely disrupt the economy. And finally, the Swedish conservative government fell, and then later the Norwegian conservatives had to make a huge compromise with the labor movement. And as a result, it was possible in those two countries to create, you might say, to open the space to be inventive and create a new economy. Denmark's progress was over a longer period of time, and it didn't come to quite such a revolutionary peak, but it nevertheless did involve general strikes at various points along the way. And their shift was a little bit slower and more gradual, but then they got there as well. And the Icelanders never did quite push their 1% out of dominance. Their economic elite was able to stay in there and still dominate to a large degree, but they had to give considerable concessions. And then Icelanders came to their great moment of truth in 2008, when, just as in this country, our bankers had gotten wild and put us at enormous risk, and then institutions were collapsing and so on. That very thing that happened in the U.S. happened on steroids in Iceland. And in fact, there was the largest financial collapse in history. And not only did the financial institutions find themselves unable to open, you couldn't even get money out of the ATM anymore. It was just this incredible stalemate. And the people rose up and threw out their government nonviolently, and also put bankers on trial. And bankers have served jail time which I think should have happened in the U.S. as well. But anyway, in Iceland, they did. So in somewhat different situations, of course, in different countries, nevertheless, all four of them had in common the turning not to armed struggle. And after all, there's a lot of romance in a lot of countries about armed struggles, the way to go. But in all four of those countries, they were able to get done the most important things that they wanted to get done through nonviolent struggle.
I was reading the article on how Swedes and Norwegians fired the 1%. And one of the things that you said in that article was that they realized that the 1% in charge, the electoral democracy was, that electoral democracy was stacked against them. So looking at our current situation where many people feel that our electoral process is broken and controlled by the 1%, and largely that elections at this point in time are bought, you have to pay to play. Do you feel that there's something that we can learn about what happened there in regard to dealing with our own electoral processes here in the United States?
Oh, yes, very much so. Very much so. One of the ways that question comes up is to compare our 30s and their 30s. And in their 30s, they were able to go over the top and make the change. And in our 30s, we didn't. We got substantial changes like Social Security and so on, but we didn't get a power shift. And I think the reason was there was still so much confidence in the electoral system in the 30s, right? And then in the 60s, we also had amazing social movements, the 60s and the 70s, that really took on incredibly tough issues and did make breakthroughs. But again, we didn't get a power shift. And again, I think it's because people had a basic kind of confidence in the economy and in the political process as being flexible enough to address at least some of our worst problems. But now we don't have that legitimacy anymore for the electoral process, as you say. And people are showing that by voting with their feet and not even going near the polls on election day, and tremendous dropping out of the Republican Party and of the Democratic Party, more and more independents. If they vote at all, they vote as independents rather than party people. And so I think we now have a very different situation. I run into people who said, well, in the 60s, we couldn't do it, so we can't do it now. And I said, no, this is very, very different. The jig is up. People understand that the electoral process is more of a kind of tantalizing scam, you know, like, oh, vote and then you will change society. And that may be what the civics textbooks told us in middle school, but that just isn't true anymore. In fact, it not only is it most people's observation, as you say, Sherry, but also some political scientists went ahead and did an empirical study to see if they could nail this contention down, this whole proposal down that the electoral process isn't working for them anymore. And it's called the Princeton study because the lead researcher was a Princeton political scientist named Martin Gillens. But what he and colleagues did was they went back to 1981 and looked at all the specific policy issues that came to a head for national decision from 1981 to 2002. So that's a little over two decades, right? They looked at 1,779 specific proposals. This took a while. They looked at each one with the question, is there agreement between the majority of people and the economic elite on this issue? Where there was an agreement, okay, never mind. When there was a disagreement, these political scientists asked, and when there was a disagreement, who got their way? The majority or the 1%? And what they found was that overwhelmingly, it was the 1% that got their way, and the majority opinion was not implemented by Congress and the president. And that's two decades in which sometimes it was a Democratic Congress completely, sometimes it was a Republican Congress, sometimes White House and Congress were both the same party. That didn't matter. The 1% got its way no matter what. And even when the majority would form mass organizations. Well, we all know mass organizations like the Retired People's Association or the Confederation of Unions, the AFL-CIO, all these various interest groups that we form, Sierra Club and so on, in the environmental field, 350.org. We form all these different groups to represent us in Washington and to advocate for us. So they looked at that and they found that that didn't seem to make any difference, that if the economic elite wanted something, they got it, no matter what conglomeration of advocacy organizations might be arguing a different way in Washington. So when BBC got hold of this study, they called it the oligarchy study and quoted the authors who said, if democracy means majority rules, that's not what we have in the United States. So I think the result of this is we're going to figure out, just as the Norwegians and Swedes figured out long ago in their old system, that if the economic elite is really in charge, then why are we kidding ourselves? We need to go for a stronger, more robust form of power than going to the polls.
I'm very glad that you brought up the Gillen's Page or the Princeton study. It's one of the most life-changing studies that I ever read. That's where I made my clean and complete break from advocating solely electoral reform. I've been constantly surprised at how much of our organizations and groups who are working for change don't seem to be able to deal with this study. They have like this cognitive dissonance about it where they can't integrate it into their understanding that we just actually don't have democracy. And if we want change through that process, then as you said, we have to go for a robust form of democracy that actually represents the people. I wanted to ask you a question a little bit about one of the common assumptions about the Scandinavian countries and why they have such life-affirming, citizen-affirming economic and political policies is often assumed to be because they're homogenous, because they're mostly white, because they don't have the same kind of divisions and complexities that the U.S. has. But my understanding from an article I read of yours in Waging Nonviolence a while back is that this is actually a myth. It's not true. And that you found that the reason that they have these robust policies is, as we've been saying, they waged struggle. Will you speak a little bit about that myth of homogeneity and perhaps a little bit about the kind of divisions that existed? I'm thinking specifically about Norway, where the 1% recruited a 100,000 person Patriot League to go beat up and break up the strikers during the labor movement. This is out of a population of 3 million. For me, that's a huge ideological division within their society. And so while they might not have had division around race at that time, they certainly were facing a rather major class division going on. Will you speak a little bit about that dynamic?
Yes, indeed. I have friends who are very worried about the militias in the United States. And I worry about them, too. But I must say, the militias don't have anything like that fraction of the population here that the league that you're referring to had in Norway. That was really, really formidable. And, of course, that was going on while Hitler was recruiting, his own very large militia called the Nazi Party and all those folks prepared to do battle in the streets against the workers. And Mussolini, the same in Italy, and in the United Kingdom also there was a similar movement. So it was a kind of Europe-wide inclination. When the class struggle is on, then you'd better get a lot of people with baseball bats out. Or maybe they didn't have baseball. Maybe they used iron bars in order to deal with them. So, yeah, that was a major, major issue, the difference between middle-class inclinations to go with whatever the dominant class says and the working-class people who are more likely to see through the pretense. And I think that that was one of the places where nonviolence made the most impact, was if in Norway and Sweden the workers had fought back violently, as what tended much more to be the case in Germany and Italy, where there were many, many more street battles between working working class formations and middle class formations, then I think the problem would have been much greater. In other words, I think Hitler benefited from all the fighting back that was going on in Germany, which tended to be especially led by the communist groups. And Mussolini also benefited from that, just as I think Donald Trump these days benefits from people who, even if they appear to be fighting, which, you know, I think our folks in this country have been really great about not fighting at Trump rallies. But nevertheless, if it even appears to be that way, then Trump wins, scores points on that. And so we can see that. I think we can imagine that dynamic as how that might have played out in those days. And so the nonviolence is a very, very important thing. Nevertheless, I would still concede that it is easier, I think, to unite more people in a social movement if they do have, say, Lutheranism in common. Almost all Norwegians were Lutheran, and Swedes. If there are some things like that that are really strongly common elements. And so when I started doing this study, I had that very much on my mind. What about the degree of diversity that we have here as compared with over there? And on my way in to meet with a couple of social scientists in an institute in Norway that does research, I happened to notice on the wall a number of framed photographs, and I looked at the wall, and at that one photograph there was an obviously smiling group of Chinese people. And I said, "What's this photograph?" And they said, "Oh, this was a delegation sent by the Chinese government to interview us in the conference room we're about to go in now for you to interview us." And they got to interview my colleagues and me. And I said, "China sent policy experts and economists to Norway to do interviews on your model?" And they said, "We were surprised as well." And as soon as we sat down around the table with these Chinese folks, we said, "So why are you here? Like, why do you think you have something to learn from us with our history of homogeneity? You have this incredible diversity in China, and you have this huge difference in scale. There's just no comparison. Why are you here?" And they said, "Oh, well, you know, it really depends on the question you're asking. Some questions, it matters what culture you're talking about and the degree of diversity. And on other questions, things can work very, very well, no matter how diverse or not a society is, and no matter what the scale." And so they plunged into the discussion. And as I reflected on that later, I remembered that the social security system that we have in the U.S., think of the scale of that compared with tiny Norway or tiny Iceland. And Social Security works fine. It could be better, but it works fine. It could be way more abundant. But as a mechanism, it works. Medicare, an analogous system to the healthcare system of Norway, gets much higher satisfaction on the part of people who are part of it than private insurance plans do in the U.S., according to the surveys. And we have a big country, but Medicare works great for the elders. Again, it needs beefing up or proteinizing or tofuizing. But anyway, it does pretty well. So a lot depends on the specifics of it. It's too big a generalization to say, oh, something that works for Norway couldn't possibly work here.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence. This week's dose of nonviolence, we're going to take a look at nonviolent action in relation to economic justice. Strikes and boycotts may pop into mind at the phrase labor movements, but we should be aware of the almost uncountable other examples of nonviolent action used by people around the world in pursuit of fair wages, safer working conditions, equal access to employment, shared ownership and decision-making opportunities, and much more. In addition to worker strikes, which are quite well known, we should all be aware of the concepts of work stoppages, slowdowns, working to rule, where you follow the rules so exactly that nothing ever gets done, call-in sicks, lightning strikes and flash walkouts, solidarity or sympathy strikes from other workers or suppliers, industry-wide strikes, craft or guild strikes, prison worker strikes, and more. On today's show, George Lakey mentions that the Norwegians use nonviolent occupations in the context of their struggle. By occupying factories or workplaces, it is possible to prevent temporary employees from operating the equipment or replace the striking workers. Other ways of waging nonviolent struggle include organizing consumer boycotts or supplier boycotts. Shipping non-cooperation can also be a powerful tool, as it was in the notorious case of the longshoremen's solidarity with the United Farm Workers when they refused to ship grapes and left them to rot on the docks. In the early U.S. labor movement, and indeed around the world as well, mutual aid arose as a powerful support system for striking workers everywhere. Providing food, money, shelter, organizing support, first aid, child care, and more, mutual aid was offered by the working class to their fellow workers who were on strike. Thinking even more broadly, movements for economic justice have employed rent strikes and social ostracism, such as in the Irish land struggles, which gave rise to the word boycott. Parallel institutions and constructive programs have helped to create new systems, such as worker cooperatives, the Mondragon Cooperative in Spain, or Gandhi's arbitration systems and peace teams, are classic examples of how such parallel institutions and constructive programs are not only prefigurative and increase the self-reliance of the movements, but can also bridge across social, cultural, economic, and political divides to create systems that serve people, not profit or power. These are just a few of the hundreds of historic examples of how nonviolent action has been used to wage struggle for economic justice. Wherever you look, these examples abound of how ordinary people work together to make extraordinary change. Know your nonviolent history. It might change your life. This week's featured music is Jog by the band Crowfoot on their album As the Crow Flies. You can find their great music at www.crowfootmusic.com. And now let's return to speaking with George Lakey.
So how do we break the work down into manageable chunks? I mean, is there a way for us to localize some of the management of some of these large-scale systems in order to make them more manageable for people in this country because of our scale and size? What do we do to address that problem in real practical ways, given the size of this country in comparison to the two countries that you're talking about?
I love that question, Sherry. That's exactly how I would like the book to be used, which is to say, okay, so there are all these different features. There are education, there's a chapter on education, chapter on how they handle health, how they handle work-life balance, how they handle environmental issues, and so on. Like, how might we apply these things, since they're so workable and have been working well for half a century over there? If we looked at those as lab experiments, then how could we apply them here? And I think you're right that there are a lot of things that we would want to decentralize. In fact, I was shocked when I asked them, well, in Norway, they found this big deposit of oil in the North Sea, belongs to Norway. The Sweden didn't find any oil at all. They're very comparable, so it's not as if oil makes the difference. In fact, Norway really had a very, very going system before they discovered Norway. But then they got this pot of money. So I asked them, what have you done with it? And they said, well, one thing we've done with it is to decentralize. And I said, decentralize? You're already such a small country. And they said, yes, we're small, but because we're so mountainous and have so many valleys where people develop different dialects and different cultural preferences and so on, we find that if we take something that seems uncomfortable, it seems like one size doesn't fit all, and decentralized decision making about this particular system, let's say some of our cultural things, we feel very strongly culture should not belong to urban areas, but it should be high culture, so to speak, or, you know, the arts and that sort of thing, but that there should be abundance of cultural opportunities in the large agricultural areas, in the small villages and so on. But that's the kind of thing we would love local people to have way more say about and way more abundant access to. And so we are using some of the oil money to decentralize and just see how far we can go with decentralization. I thought I was talking to some anarchists for a minute. And so I love that question. And I would love it if people just said, okay, let's take this model, see how it can be applied to the U.S., and then see what the decentralized possibilities are that would make things more variable to fit local situations.
George, do you think we could speak a little bit about the what we keep referring to as the model and the Scandinavian economics or Viking economics, and kind of break that down for some of our listeners who may have a general sense of the economic well-being of the Scandinavian countries, but not necessarily know about the specific choices that those countries have made that helped them create a more equal and just society on the income and wealth spectrum?
One feature of their economy that it is, I think, very friendly to a lot of us here is the big emphasis on cooperatives. A very high proportion in each country, especially Sweden and Norway, but also in Denmark and Iceland, a large portion of the economy is devoted to co-ops, both consumer co-ops and also producer co-ops. Agriculture this is true in Denmark as well. Agriculture in Denmark as well as Sweden and Norway would fall apart if it weren't for the co-ops, producers co-ops, farmers co-ops. 97% of milk in Denmark, for example, is processed, homogenized, packaged, and so on, made available, turned into cheese and all the rest by co-ops. Big emphasis on cooperative, producer cooperatives, insurance cooperatives, banking, credit unions, that kind of thing. And they believe that there's not only major efficiencies to be found in cooperative enterprise, but also a lot of resilience. So one reason why they put a lot of emphasis on co-ops is because co-ops do provide a kind of resilience that the capitalist system very often doesn't do. On the other hand, they don't just let the capitalist system alone. They value markets for the flexibility that the market offers. On the other hand, because they don't trust corporations to look out for the common good, because they tend to be so self-centered and absorbed in profit, they build in a number of ways of keeping the common good foremost in front of them. For example, in Norway, all the major corporations are owned over 50% by the public in one form or another, either by the national government or by municipalities in some form or other publicly owned. So that means if some CEO says, oh, I found this great way of saving money. Instead of building these pipes and recycling operations, we can just dump this fertilizer dump this waste into the river. There's no way they can get away with that, because at the table are representatives of the public. In addition to that, which is itself such a major factor, the biggest resource of all in Norway in terms of actual money is the oil. And the decision when the oil was discovered, national debate happened. What do we do with this oil? And there was agreement that the people as a whole should benefit from that, and it should be a publicly owned, created corporation that would exploit the oil and distribute it and so on. So that still exists today, Stott Oil. They decided that at one point they wanted to capitalize it a little bit more, and so they sold stock for a small part of it, but it's still majority owned by the public. So that's a very important feature of the Nordic model. The largest bank in Norway used to be private. There's a lot of public banks and credit unions, but there were also as head of private banks, and one of the private banks got to be the number one bank. Then it became irresponsible, along with two other fairly large commercial banks, became irresponsible in the late 80s when some regulations were taken off. And they created a bubble, and based mainly on a real estate bubble, and then it burst in the early 90s. So the Norwegian government stepped in and seized those banks on behalf of the public, fired the senior management, made sure the shareholders didn't get a dime, and then slowly rehabilitated those banks to clean them up. So then it sold the number two and number three banks back to the private sector, just sort of sold them through stock, but hung on to the very largest one, saying, "You're the biggest one. We're just going to own you." So maybe that gives you the flavor of this continual assertion that it's the common good that needs to be in charge of the economy rather than the economy being in charge of people's lives.
One of the things that's interesting to me about this story is that you're talking about Norway's economy being built in part on oil production, yet Norway has come forward and pledged to become climate neutral by 2030, and also has recently passed some type of bill to end deforestation in the country in order to help meet those goals. And when we look at the difference between the way that the oil and gas industry runs unchecked and is trying to create a carbon credit program to displace their pollution rather than end it, and you look at what's going on in a small country like Norway, where they actually have oil production as part of their economy, making decisions that are seemingly completely opposite of one another. And it has a lot more to do with, to me, the ethics that's driving it, as you just said, where the people are actually driving the economies rather than the economies are driving the people. Here, it's just the opposite. And so to me, that's a mental and spiritual illness that has pervaded our society, at least pervaded capitalism and turned that itself into a mental illness or spiritual illness. So how do we address that disparity in the ethics that underlies that decision-making to be able to switch to more humane and equitable, just relationship with the natural world?
I asked that question of the Norwegian director of Greenpeace, because the Greenpeace there, as maybe we could say here as well, is one of the more radical environmental organizations. And I had a great interview with him in which I asked him, so how do you see Norway proceeding? And he said, it's misleading to just look at how we're doing compared with the rest of the world, because we look great in that way, or at least actually we don't look as great as Denmark and Sweden in that way, but we look great as compared with most countries. However, we still are not where we need to be. And so Greenpeace has been sailing its ships into the Arctic area to contest the Norwegian wish to continue extracting oil north of the North Sea. It's up in the Arctic, which could have devastating economic and environmental consequences if there were a spill there. But even if there weren't a spill, as you say, it continues to contribute to climate change. So Greenpeace is part of actually probably a majority of Norwegians who think that it's wrong to keep extracting oil and gas and that they should leave it in the ground. However, it's a very, very live controversy there. In fact, a government recently fell because the fight was so bitter on the parliamentary level. And so in my book, I put the discussion of climate change among those four countries in a chapter or in a section of the book called Struggles for Them and Us Both. Because in earlier chapters, it's mostly they've solved this. How can we adapt it? But in with regard to racism, and also with because they, racism is an issue in the Nordic countries, and with regard to climate change, they still have work to do. As you say, they do have a very ambitious goal. It's not actually 2030; it's 2050 that they want to go carbon neutral. And they're lagging behind on achieving that goal. On the other hand, they are back now to the amount of emissions that existed in the 1990s. So that they are making progress, but they're not making as fast progress as they want to. They've got to shift completely to electric cars. They've got a zillion, you know, all their new housing has to be of carbon neutral, that people aren't allowed to build houses anymore that are not carbon neutral, that kind of thing. They're moving ahead rapidly, but from the point of view of Greenpeace and many people, they're not moving at all quickly enough.
Well, this may be good news. There was an article in The Guardian yesterday that said Norway pledges to become climate neutral by 2030, 20 years earlier than planned.
And oh, that's good news.
Parliament had approved some pretty radical and accelerated emission cuts in carbon offsetting too, which, I have my own problems with carbon offsetting, but they have changed the date on it as of yesterday.
Wonderful. So, yeah. Well, that's really a testament to how important people's movements are, because that's really, really good news. 2030. That puts them with Denmark, because Denmark also wants to get there by 2030.
I think it's great. There's probably I suspect there's a little bit of healthy competition between them that kind of says, hey, Sweden's got this great policy over there. How come we don't? I wish the U.S. could take that perspective. Although, you know, that's what Michael Moore's new film really kind of brought up for me, of Where to Invade Next was the title of the film. And he brought back all these stunning policies and programs from Europe that just had me weeping in my seat about how insane our country is. And so here's the question for you, George. With all of your research, both in the Scandinavian countries and also looking at our own country, the United States, where do you see the work needing to start or needing to focus? Are we talking about a cultural social shift or an economic shift in labor, work, consumption, business, or a political revolution? Or is it a simultaneously occurring all three of those? What's your insight on that?
I do think all of the above, actually. When I talk with the radical visionaries in the Nordic countries, they emphasize that they haven't given up coming up with larger and more profound and more spiritually based visions. And so they attack the complacency that a lot of Nordic people feel. Well, we're at the top of the charts, all the international charts comparing us with other countries, so now we can relax. And they say, no, we need to go much farther. And I do think that that's correct, that each of us, wherever we are in the U.S. or over there or in Africa or Asia, we should each be in touch with our own integrity and also go to the cultural background that we come from, because there's almost always inspiration there from, you know, prophetic voices that have often been many years before us, saying this needs to be done, that needs to be done, we deserve this, we deserve that, and the right relationship with the earth and with other people requires this and that of us. I think it is exciting to talk with visionaries and be with them. One reason why I wrote this book, in fact, was to try to get more Americans talking on the level of vision, because I don't think there's quite enough legitimacy in the U.S. to go to the visionary level, to really really sink into our spirits and allow them to speak to us. And so it leaves people in this kind of incremental, well, maybe we could get this through Congress in the next 2 years or that kind of thing, which is so, so far away from what's possible. So I thought, well, if I wrote this book, even though the Nordic radicals aren't themselves satisfied with where they've gotten, from an American point of view, they've already taken this huge step that for us would be extraordinary. And maybe if Americans got talking about, what about this huge step? Then maybe we would somehow become more confident and go beyond the year-by-year incrementalism and make big enough achievements forward so that then we could go even deeper. One of the Norwegians that is most responsible for the environmental sensibility of Norwegians is the guy who started deep ecology, a guy named Arne Næss, philosopher at the University of Oslo, who I met when I was a very young student there, studying at Oslo. And deep ecology is right there, and his book is in the bookstores today about that. And people are reading him and saying, and that's the kind of discussion that we deserve to have. But I think that we aren't likely to have it in a very meaningful way until we have some sense of momentum that we are at least moving forward. That was I loved the utopian thinking, for example, in the 70s. Where feminists were imagining societies in which women were fully equal with men and breaking out of the sex role prescriptions, that kind of thing. But I think that the visionary work that was being done in the 70s happened because we were already riding on some momentum from the 60s and believed that it was worth our time to imagine boldly. And so that's what I'd like to do. I'd like to, while agreeing with all those things that you said, Rivera, that probably the priority on that, I would say right now, would be to get momentum through campaigns that achieve goals, just as Earthquaker Action Team developed a campaign that pushed the seventh largest bank of the country in the country out of funding mountaintop removal coal mining, that we achieve goals and then develop our self-confidence. Well, we can do something here. And then the next goal and the next goal. And next thing you know, we've got movements, because movements are often accumulated by campaigns. And then we can go to that really imaginative level that human beings so deserve to be on.
There are a couple of things I want to touch on. First, I've mentioned Næss before in this show. We've done shows on reconciliation ecology, deep ecology, talked about some of these things at length. And one of the struggles that I have had and decided that it wasn't going to be my focus is the fact that, like so many others, Næss is talking about the indigenous relationship with the earth as some of the founding principles of what he called deep ecology. And so you have these indigenous concepts that are being claimed and relabeled and then synthesized within somebody else's cultural relevance and then kind of pumped out into the society. And then that person becomes the father of it, the founder of it. And it just, as an indigenous woman, it always just makes me roll my eyes. But that's an aside.
This is a great moment to remind our listeners that we are speaking with George Lakey, who is the author of Viking Economics, which is his 9th book. And he writes these books in the nature of homework for the movement, supporting all of us as we do our activism and helping us work for a better world altogether. He's the co-founder of Earthquaker Action Team, a longtime thinker and theorist and practitioner of nonviolence in all forms and shapes and sizes. And we are really glad to have him on the show. Sherry, why don't you give George a last question or any last thoughts?
Wonderful. Thank you, Rivera. George, I think that what you just said prior to my eye roll comment was that we need to get this out and to create movements. And some of the other work that you've done involves large-scale training, this organization that you helped found, Training for Change. And one of the ways that I found to create change relatively quickly is to educate people and to help them understand how they're going to benefit from the change that needs to come. And so do you think that a broad-scale strategic campaign of education and training for individuals to help get the word out about how this will benefit the U.S. society would be a good strategy for moving things in that direction?
I do indeed. For example, what if the people who've worked for Bernie Sanders said, okay, let's take one of his proposals and create a campaign, a nonviolent direct action campaign that would demand that we, for example, got free higher education, and then we go for it and allow the economic elite to fight back because they've been responsible for defunding now for years from public education, including on the higher education level. And we'll have a civil rights movement level interaction and confrontation with the 1% and see what happens. And that concretizing of a demand that would benefit so many people and is a commonsensical demand because the Nordics have had the free higher education for many, many years, including back in the days when they didn't have much money. That commonsensical kind of approach would be very revealing, I think, for all the folks in the middle who still hope that the economic elite can lead us. And then they will just discover, well, the economic elite is leading us into a blind alley. Let's do something way better than that.
I like the point that you bring up that the economic elite is not going to save us from this problem. It's not in their interest. And you know what? I actually don't think it's in their skill set. I think that if we want to see change, we're going to have to turn to our heroes and role models in the Norway, Sweden, Iceland, Denmark, also toward our own history with the early labor movement, the kind of level of organizing that goes along with that sort of sustained campaign, and towards all of our heroes in nonviolent struggle. This kind of thing can happen, and I love that you brought up that we have to have the vision, we have to have the scope of imagination, and we need to organize around that. George, is there any last words you'd like to say as we're heading out of today's show?
One of the things reflected in my book is the tremendous pragmatism that goes on over there. Well, we can be just as pragmatic over here. Let's be practical. Let's build those movements. Let's win our goals. And let's open the space for a real democracy.
And thank you so much, George, for joining us.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution.
Thanks this week to our incredible guest, Mr. George Lakey, and to my amazing co-host, Rivera Sun. Our theme song, Love and Revolution, Words and Music by Diane Patterson, is performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And you can find George Lakey's book, Viking Economics, at the very straightforward and simple website, www.vikingeconomics.org. I want to thank Sherry Mitchell for her insightful comments and reflections in today's show and all of our shows. You can follow Sherry on her Sacred Instructions Facebook page. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program, and your local radio station can broadcast it. Big shout out to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, also to Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and to KOWA in Olympia, Washington, for picking up Love and Revolution Radio and broadcasting it in their local area. And we are Love and Revolution Radio on Stitcher, iTunes, and Podomatic.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Sherry Mitchell. Today, George Lakey told us how the descendants of the ancient Vikings, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and Iceland, are at the top of international ratings for freedom, equality, health, economic productivity, and reducing climate change. And he also gives us hope to believe that we can experience the same type of change here. So maybe you can order your copy of Viking Economics to see what you can do to create this type of change in your local area by the time we talk to you next week. Thank you.